Hello, chaps. It's Ben here. I'm flying solo this week at the start of the podcast because Barry is busy beavering away in preparation for a big audition tomorrow. Let's get straight down to business. I want to chat to you guys about Patreon. If you've listened to our past few episodes, we've been going on about the fact that we finally got a Patreon page, which will allow all of you listeners to help support us and help grow the podcast into something even better than it currently is. We started our Patreon page about 2 weeks ago, and already loads of people have supported us, and it means the world to us. And I'll be honest, we didn't expect it to go this well this quickly, but we've already got 10 supporters, which means we've hit our first goal on Patreon, and it means that each of those 10 supporters are going to get access to a special episode where we're going to go in-depth on one of our 76 world's worst subjects. Me and Barry are going to have a chat about which one we want to do an in-depth episode on, and we'll pop it on our social media to let you know. It's so lovely that a bunch of people who we know actually live close by and also live on the other side of the world are helping to support us make this Daft Wee podcast, which has grown and grown and grown. And if you're listening to this and think, do you know what? I always have a little giggle listening to Ben and Barry and I learn something a little bit new. And you fancy helping us out? This is your opportunity. We're not asking for big bucks. We're asking for the equivalent of a cup of coffee, couple of pints, maybe a nice sandwich once a month that will help support us as we do it and help us go on and grow the podcast in a variety of ways. Here's the lowdown of what you get. You can donate as low as $2 a month, but here's where it gets interesting. If you donate $3 a month, you will get extra content every single month. If you donate $5 a month, you can suggest a topic that we'll do. More on that in a minute. $10 a month, you can come onto the show in real life or via Skype and be a judge. We're in dreamland now, but if you give us $20 a month, then in that case, you can come on and be an entire guest, and we'll make a special episode for you about a world's worst thing that we've clearly omitted from a previous show. Last of all, getting daft now, but if you want to donate $50 a month of your money to us, firstly, listen to our episode about the world's worst therapists and go and have a chat to Lily. But if you're really up for that, we'll come to your house. We will record a one-off episode there just for you and your mates. And me and another stand-up comedian of my choosing will perform a specially curated stand-up comedy show for you, in addition to all of the other rewards. Now, one last thing. It is absolutely imperative that we name and laud the 10 people who have donated to us so far. First up, hilariously, two of our donors are former guests. Kia Shields, who did the Doctor episode, and Lydia Mizon, who did the quiz contestant episode. So thank you to them. And they're joined with Catherine Pugh and one other pal of ours, Aubrey Vora, who designed our logo and is a wonderful artist. You can look her up at curiosapiens.com. Hey, it's the nature of Patreon. Sometimes it's good old mates. But the other six, they're people who, God love you, never met you before. Oh, I tell a lie, one of them, Alan Sharp. I met Alan in Edinburgh when I did my show last year. So thank you to him. Thank you to Dave Lambert, to Andy Elms, Daniel Grocott, Ellen Alina, and Trev O'Connor. Honestly, it's really sweet that you keep supporting us. And me and Barry are going to work really hard to give you the great podcast that you love. So, want a nice little ego bubble bath of having your name read out at the start of this podcast? Come on board, be a donor. And not only that, you can be a patron of us and engage us to make work that you want to hear. Oh, one last thing. I got some nice messages from you guys about my tiny new Bambino. So that's really sweet of you as well. That's super cool. Anyway, it is on with a special one-off episode. Me and Barry will tell you a bit more of it in it. We're adopting holding patterns whilst I get my life in order as my kids turned up. But hopefully we'll be back a week today with a brand new episode of Worst Foot Forward with a brand new guest and some truly terrible things from the history of mankind.
Let's Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Worst Foot Forward. I'm Ben van der Velde. This is the podcast where each week we celebrate the best of the worst. Except for this week, we're celebrating the best of the best. And by that, I don't mean the 1989 Taekwondo-based movie, nor do I mean that we celebrate the best of the best of the best, which is what the US Navy SEALs want to be. And most importantly, I don't mean we're celebrating the best of the best, a compilation album of the band The Best, a supergroup featuring Keith Emerson from Emerson, Lake & Palmer, John Entwistle from The Who, Joe Walsh from The Eagles, and two other men who do not deserve to be in a group called The Best. And with me, being the embodiment of The Best, a man who in another alternate universe is a US Navy SEAL Taekwondo champion and also the manager of the band The Best, it's Barry The Best McStay.
That's fun. Who are the other two? Is that a real supergroup, The Best?
That's a real supergroup.
I've never heard of them. Who are the other two?
They were Jeff Baxter, who was in a group not as good as them, and a guy called Simon Phillips.
Right.
Who I'm pretty certain was
like the roadies.
Yeah.
Playing the triangle at the back.
Pretty much. They're the ones who are just like, and on fourth guitar, that you can't hear because it's playing the same chords as second guitar, just in a slightly different setting.
This is a new departure for us. And so we decided we're occasionally going to do these one-off little episodes, just the two of us.
Yeah.
And we're going to go back over subjects we've covered in our back catalogue, but do the best of those rather than the worst.
Yeah, it's because, let's face it, the world is often a deeply worrisome, confusing piece of shitbaggery.
Going to hell in a handbasket.
Yes, it is. Thank you for picking the correct
cliche. What other type
of
basket is there? To hell in a picnic basket.
Yeah. A delicious apocalypse.
A delicious apocalypse. If you knew the world was ending tomorrow, what would be your last meal?
Challah and Marmite. Done.
Right to the end.
Right.
Being both Jewish and divisive.
Oh, God, I wouldn't want to end up at St. Peter's pearly gates and be like, well, we see that you've been eating the holy bread since you were a little boy, but unfortunately, God doesn't like Marmite, so down to the bad place you go.
That was it. Heaven for you would be a Jewish bakery, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, a Jewish bakery staffed by the Beatles.
In Golders Green, what's that one?
Carmelli's.
Carmelli's, yeah. Oh, delicious Carmelli's. Oh. So yeah, this episode, first of all, if you've not listened to us before, this is not what we usually do, so maybe go back and listen to one of the other ones.
Yeah.
But if you have listened to us before, you'll know all of this right from the word go. We'd love you to follow us on the social media places like Twitter. We're on at Worst Foot. Ben is individually on at Ben van der Velde and I'm at Baz McStay.
And way more importantly than our own ego bubble baths. If you enjoy previous episodes, or you've enjoyed this first 5 minutes, or you enjoy the next 45, pop on iTunes or Stitcher, give us a 5-star rating, write a cheeky 1-word review, subscribe on your phone, subscribe on your friends' phones, and you can also check out our new website, www.worstfootforwardpodcast.com. Even if we do say so ourselves, it looks pretty nice.
It's shiny, shiny. Lots of photos of us, photos of our guests, and all of our old episodes are all there in one place, so you can check them out. So this episode, we are going to look at the subjects from our very first 5 episodes. Jesus Christ, we recorded those nearly 2 years ago.
Yeah, we really did.
Like, Sophie was October, I think.
October 2016,
something like that.
Oh, what a lovely time that was.
Yeah. Oh, God. Before the election.
Yeah.
After Brexit, though, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
We thought Brexit was the worst electoral outcome there would ever be.
What a dreadful perineum of time that was.
Harry Potter and the Perineum of Time.
Coming to an Amsterdam playhouse near you. So yeah, let's do it subject by subject. So the very first one, we started both scientific and miserable. We decided to talk about the world's worst psychological treatment.
That was with Professor Sophie Scott.
Yeah.
Neuroscientist and deliverer of the Royal Academy Christmas lecture and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
So
I think
without
we peaked
her here,
with our first guest.
So without her here, we've decided to tell you what the best psychological treatment is. With Sophie, we picked psychosurgery as the world's worst.
Do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I read about something called chess therapy.
No, that's what I read about!
Oh, did you? Well, this is good. At least we know it's a winner straight from the word
go.
Did you read about anything else?
Like a couple of things, but I wrote about the guy. Did you read about the guy who invented it?
That's amazing. So first of all, chess therapy immediately appealed to probably both of us as board gamers.
Yes.
If you're the psychologist, you get to sit down and play games of chess with your patients. And if you're the patient, you know, instead of having someone doing attack therapy or aversion therapy or any of those, you're just like, fancy a game of chess? What sort of gambit will you open with?
The thing is, chess therapy would not be therapeutic for me, because whenever I play chess against my wife, I always take all of her pieces and then spend the rest of the game chasing her king around the board, because I don't know how to checkmate.
And that's why Ben has a problem with attainability.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was invented by this guy called Razi's, Muhammad ibn Zakariya al-Razi, who was a Persian physician, philosopher from the 9th and 10th century, which is amazing. Like, it's 1,000 years old, this idea of sitting down and using, and he would use chess, the metaphors within chess, to as metaphors for people's difficulties and strategies for overcoming them and things like that. They played a version of chess. It wasn't the version we know today. Did you have the name written down anywhere?
No, I don't.
Yeah, it was a different version of chess that we play nowadays.
Because the reason where checkmate comes from is, it's from anyone. It's
Shahmate.
Shahmate, yeah, that's
the
one.
The king is dead.
The king is dead, yeah.
And yeah, he, as I said, this was like pre the fall of Baghdad and sort of the decline of, if you like, Islamic
philosophy. It's 300 years before that.
But it sort of didn't really reach the West until the early 1900s, basically. A little bit slow on the uptake there in the West. Did you read about the case from the 1940s of the little boy? The 16-year-old.
Oh, no, I didn't read on that. I went down the rabbit hole of Razi's. I love
it. Oh, cool.
Him.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit more of the chess, and you can tell the listeners about that. In the 1940s, there was this case study of a 16-year-old boy who was schizophrenic and very isolated. And through playing games of chess with him, his physicians discovered that it allowed him to express his feelings and his fantasies and his dreams in a way that he was never able to do in normal conversation, because it gave him a sort of a sense of control. And an ability to plan, and he was able to sort of, in a way, master his emotions in some ways through playing chess. So it's a really a fun way of being treated, but also it seems quite effective. And some people talk about it as being a version of creative therapy. There was a recent study where it shows that you can, obviously you can aim at victory, which is important in life, but also you can develop and learn from your defeats as well. And it shows you whether your place in life or how you view yourself is as like a victim or a martyr or as childish or ambitious or whatever. And then the psychoanalysts come along and ruin it for everybody by talking about wish fulfillment and repression.
And how all the pieces look like different penises.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason the queen is so great is because she's sexy, like your mum. So we know what Freud is like. But yeah, there was this California study, an experiment there that showed after 20 days of playing chess, 55% of the school students had better academic results after just 20 days of playing chess. And there's another 5-year study done by a guy called Robert Ferguson that showed that the students who played chess had a 17.3% improvement in their academic abilities, as opposed to a 4.56% improvement for those who weren't allowed to play chess. Can you imagine being the wrong side of that draw when they did that in class? Going, we're going to do this experiment, and some of you are going to like whiz ahead, like nearly a 20% improvement in your grades.
Yeah, whereas you guys are going to play Ludo for 3 weeks.
You're like, no, we need control subjects, but we're failing. go on, tell them about Razi. He's amazing. He's one of the most impressive people I've never heard of.
Yeah, that's a great title for a book. Most impressive people you've never heard of. Written by two people you've never heard of. Yeah. One thing with chess therapy, I will say, I, having read about it, have got a theory that Donald Trump went to psychoanalysis as a young boy and they made him play Monopoly instead of chess. And that's how he's ended up as he
Monopoly
did.
Monopoly therapy.
Monopoly therapy, yeah.
Go to jail.
Somehow always able to buy himself out. Razi's. Show a bit of respect for a long-dead Islamic polymath, please. Yeah. Hey, wouldn't that be incredible, though, if we went to the Razi's in Hollywood and went, actually, these statuettes that you're being handed out for being such an awful actor or actress, they've got real depth to them.
Yeah, it's in honour of 10th century medicine.
because your performance hurt as much as 10th century surgery. So he's... was a pioneer in experimental medicine. Mm. He also would happily cure the rich and the poor, which is what all doctors should
do. Yeah, he wrote about these ethics of, like, you should treat everybody.
Yeah, it's almost like he updated Hippocrates.
Yeah.
Because who is it? I think it was Keir said that the Hippocratic Oath is ridiculous.
Yeah,
because
when we did World's Worst Doctor. Yeah,
yeah, in order to practice any modern medicine, you basically have to break the Hippocratic Oath immediately because you're going to hurt someone.
Yeah.
He also developed humoral theory, which is about who is and is not funny. Mm. he correctly identified the symptoms of smallpox and measles.
Yeah, he distinguished them. Previously, I think people thought they were the same thing.
Yeah.
You see, the World Health Organization praised him in 1970. Like 1,000 years after he did that, they were like, oh, this is the first guy who did this, and it's important work that he recognised this, and his treatises on infectious diseases
That's
were really
incredible.
Important 1,000 years later.
Well, it's because in Europe, we think of medieval medicine as being leeches, just throw leeches at them. And
yeah.
Obviously, the Muslim world was miles ahead of us, and I think either there weren't enough enlightened doctors over here to take from it, or they just didn't know about it, or
yeah.
they were like, well, we don't want to use heathen medicine, but it'll stop me dying. Well, you'll go to heaven and get to tango with Jesus.
Yeah, well, some of his recipes for medicine sound quite nice. It's like herbs and spices.
Yeah, exactly. They all sound like mocktails, essentially.
Yeah.
There's loads of rose petal in it.
Speaking of, did you see he isolated compounds like sulfuric acid
and
alcohol?
I
thought that was the bit that would stand out.
Yeah, absolutely. It was great. So, like, so you're a Muslim medic, and
yeah.
you've discovered that. Well, alcohol's very important for a night out.
Yeah.
He's also considered the father of paediatrics
mm.
and sort of the godfather of ophthalmology.
Yeah.
He also wrote a home medical manual called For One Who Has No Physician to Attend
Him. Yeah, so like that sort of democratisation of healthcare again.
Yeah.
It's
and
really, really good.
My favourite thing about him is some of the titles of his books
yeah.
are magnificent.
He's written loads.
Yeah, he is. He's a publishing phenomenon, Harry.
he was definitely like self-publishing for a lot of the time, though.
You reckon? What?
I don't think there were many publishers who went, For One Who Has No Physician to Attend Him is a very catchy title.
That's true, but yeah, you're right. It seems like a very lumpy bit of poetry, really, doesn't
yeah.
it? He also wrote The Book of Simple Medicine, The Great Book of Crabbedin, The Little Book of Crabbedin, The Book of Disasters, Food and Its Harmfulness, The Book of Toothaches, About the Ear Hole...
But not inside
but
it.
But not inside it. Now, that's with David Frost.
Yeah.
The Thirst of Fishing, and probably not the housewife's favourite, Sleep Sweating.
How do you get a whole book out of that?
Yeah, I could barely get
chapter
a page.
One. Okay, he sleep sweated in this first chapter. Now where does it go to, Razzies? I think we'll just do some more sleep sweating in chapter 2.
Yeah, well, no, but maybe chapter 3, Enter the Humidifier.
He wasn't all brilliant, it has to be said. He did think mental health issues were caused by demons, and he was a big fan of alchemy. Just to
yep.
play devil's alchemist there for a second.
Man of his time. No, but clearly, he goes, like, right, we're going to play chess therapy, and he'd start playing chess, and the demons that are in your head were going, that is a fucking awful move. I'm not spending a minute longer inside this head. Off I go.
Yeah.
One little thing, because I adore this. I did also read two little things, one about nude psychotherapy. A chap called Paul Bindrim, who was very much of his time, guy in the 1960s, but he suggested if both the psychotherapist and the patient, or preferably patients, took off their clothes
yes.
and were exposed themselves physically, would expose themselves mentally, and they would reach sort of these peak experiences together.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I checked, and he hasn't been outed as any sort of dodgy chap. It was very honest, hippie psychotherapy.
But that's why Harvey Weinstein was so quick to head to therapy as soon as he got caught.
My one issue with him is he had one technical phrase that you don't ever want a psychotherapist to say, which is crotch eyeballing.
What's that? I mean, yeah.
It's where you examine each other's crotches.
Oh, right.
What did you think it was?
No, I thought it was something you'd be like, okay, in this session, we have a few rules. There's no crotch eyeballing. But the way you're laying it out, it sounds like, no, it was part of the treatment.
No, absolutely was. It was.
Jesus.
I don't know how closely you eyeball.
Eyeball. Eyeball to eye.
Eyeball to eye. Good. Well done. The only other one, which sounds lovely, there's a Swiss psychologist called Dora Kalf, who developed a version of art therapy. therapy called sandcastle therapy.
Oh, adorable.
So basically, whatever, it's particularly for people who've suffered from sort of trauma in childhood, but they would use the sand to build images of what it was that was troubling them.
But then let it wash away.
Of course.
Oh, that's beautiful. I like that. Well, then it seems we're both agreed that chess therapy is the very best psychological treatment.
Yeah,
well done,
absolutely.
Razzies. That's a tick straight out the box.
He's got the World Health Organization on side, so he doesn't need us.
With Beck Hill, we did the world's worst superhero. We chose her fictional superheroes, the X-Men, who included such luminaries as Wolverine and Magneto, both with dogs.
Yeah.
Who have you got for this? Have you gone niche? Have you gone big time?
No, I've gone big time. I've gone Iron Man.
Ooh, why? Why is Iron Man the best?
Because I want to be him. There's the line in the first Avengers movie, I think, where Captain America says, "What are you without the suit? Billionaire philanthropist playboy." It's like, great. That I love the swagger with which he walks. I love the way that Downey Jr. plays him. And I love the suit. The way the suit progresses. Because ultimately, as a superhero, I want to be able to fly. But I don't want to be Superman because of the curse of Superman.
Yeah.
Spider-Man looks fun, with all of the, firing all of the spider goo, but the way that he loses Uncle Ben. Yeah, Uncle Ben, too heartbreaking.
Every time Uncle Ben is mentioned, I just think of rice, though.
Uncle Ben just fires rice out of his wrists instead. And then one of the things is he always fires more rice than he thinks he needs.
Yeah. It gets wet and it just overflows.
Yeah. But I sort of looked into Stan Lee's thinking behind writing Iron Man.
So when did Iron Man first come about?
60s.
60s, okay.
Yeah.
Because obviously with some superheroes you can go, okay, well, this is a Cold War thing, or this is a feminist thing, or what? Mm-hmm. Why was Iron Man?
So it was invented? A Cold War thing, but basically his challenge was, he said, most of his readers were people who were born in the 40s, 50s, or even 60s. They hated the war, they hated the military. So he decided to mess with them and to write something who represented this to the 100th degree as a weapons manufacturer, as an industrialist, as a rich man. Bear in mind, he's writing this at the back end of the 60s, and I'm pretty certain Stan Lee's reasonably progressive with his politics.
Yeah.
So he's deliberately messing with them. What's fascinating, if you know the first Iron Man movie, obviously he's showing off weaponry in Afghanistan, and he gets captured by Afghan rebels, he helps an Afghan doctor who's also captured. That is lifted from the very first story, but it's set in Vietnam. And it's exactly the same. It's a Vietnamese doctor who nurses him back to health and builds the contraption.
The dilithium crystals or whatever they are.
Come on. Bye, 100 listeners. Bye. Stan Lee also said he based him entirely on Howard Hughes. Howard Hughes is one of the most colourful men of our time. He was an inventor, an adventurer, a multi-billionaire, a ladies' man, and finally, a nutcase. Without being crazy, this guy was Howard Hughes. Nice. And what's most fascinating about Iron Man, and Stan Lee said, of all the comic books that they published, Iron Man got more fan mail from women and girls than anyone else.
Interesting.
And they're normally addressed directly to Iron Man. So that's another reason that I want to be Iron Man.
Yeah.
It's also, one last thing, it's the way he flies. Like the way Superman flies, particularly Christopher Reeve, never better, that sort of weird one arm over his, arcing over his head thing. But the having magical stigmata boosters that Iron Man does.
Is his
so
suit
satisfying.
Made of iron in the comics?
That's a good
he's question. Going to rust. that's a worry. I think that's a chink in the armor, so to speak.
That is an issue. Well, because obviously, by the time you get to the movies, it's nanotechnology, and I love all the stuff where you just flick a switch and the suit builds around him.
I know, that is immensely cool, because it's basically like, and when the suits can come to his aid, it's like having a sidekick who isn't an annoying sidekick.
Yes.
It's just the suit who I can then dress myself in and shut up when I don't want him to do any wisecrack.
Yeah, just like put wisecracking mode off.
Yeah.
That's what you want.
Well, I looked at a few metrics for who would be the best superhero. First of all, I looked at box office returns for individual superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
So by my metric, Iron Man would be the second best superhero, because the average amount of money Iron Man makes at the box office is $390,297,800. Obviously, the Avengers made loads of money, but the Avengers is a massive group. So the Fantastic Four, so have the...
Fantastic Four made loads of money.
Well, they've made some money. And so have Guardians of the Galaxy as well. So obviously they don't quite count. Superman, you think, he's had the most films with him in. He's had 11 with four different directors. He comes in third, $314 million, but he has made in his time over those 11 movies nearly $3.5 billion at the box office, which is very impressive. Who would you guess is the best at making money at the box office?
I mean, Tony Stark would be disappointed that it isn't him.
Yeah.
It must be Captain America.
Batman has done the best in terms of the most amount of money made, not per movie. He's made over nearly $3.5 billion at the box office over his 11 movies, but is only third in average. Who would you think is the best?
Is it Captain America?
No, not Captain America. I can tell you there's been 5 movies about this character. It's made... $2,091,535,500.
Is it Officer John McClane?
No, sadly. It is Spider-Man.
Oh.
Believe it or not, yeah, it's Spidey. He averages $418 million per movie. It's nearly $30 million more than Iron Man in second place per movie. So Spidey's doing pretty well for a kid, for a teenager.
Yeah, exactly. And given the current narrative in the Avengers movies, I think that would really piss off Tony Stark.
Yeah. Particularly because they have to keep recycling Spider-Men. Because they grow up so fast.
Well, they grow up so fast, and what happens is obviously the producer just comes along with a massive glass and pops it over the actor, slides a cardboard over it, and then throws them into San Francisco Bay.
I would really like it if they had to keep them. Like if it was still Tobey Maguire nearly 20 years later trying to play a 16-year-old.
There must be some comic books where Spider-Man gets old. Because obviously the last Wolverine movie, he gets old.
Yeah.
And... I got bought for my birthday by my wife a collection of Neil Gaiman comics, like a writing of the DC heroes. And I'm sure there's one of them where Batman's just ancient. he's stuck together with spit and bits of string. And
I would really enjoy a superhero's retirement village.
Oh, that'd be amazing. Well, yeah, Batman, he's got the Bat Walker.
Yeah.
And he's got the Bat Colostomy bag.
I looked at the superhero who has single-handedly saved the most lives.
Oh, excellent.
And that probably, I mean, there's lots of potential options, but individually I reckon Jean Grey from the X-Men is probably pretty close. Because the storyline where she is consumed by Phoenix, who's this sort of amazing super being, when she's Phoenix, she basically devours a star. killing 4 billion people who live on a planet that orbits around that star. And the implication is that if she just let Phoenix control her forever, she would destroy the universe and basically kill everybody.
So she sacrifices billion lives?
Well, she devoured that star as Phoenix. So to stop her killing anyone else in the universe, Jean Grey kills herself and just doesn't let Phoenix... inhabit her body anymore. So by sacrificing herself, Jean Grey essentially saved the entire universe minus that one star, that one planet with 4 billion people on it.
I mean, this feels unfair to do this calculation before part 2 of Infinity War comes out, doesn't it?
But that's only half the universe, remember.
X-Men on the spoilers,
have you not seen the first part?
I have.
Yeah, well, that's fine.
Our listeners might not have.
Oh, fuck off. Come on. Darth Vader is Luke's dad, for those of you who are still catching up.
What about Superman saving... he saves the entire planet Earth.
Yeah, but that's just Earth. That's like 6 billion people. I think Jean Grey... And she kills herself to do it. I think that's pretty impressive.
Yes.
But I have got one better for you.
Okay.
Have you seen or read any of The Watchmen?
Yes.
Things. Dr. Manhattan.
Yes.
I mean, I'm just going to list Dr. Manhattan's powers and abilities and let you try and tell me that any other superhero is better than him. For those who don't know, Dr. Manhattan is a sort of a 60s creation. He's scientist, I think. He's created because he steps into a machine which actually disintegrates him. Mm-hmm. And he manages to reconstruct himself at an atomic level and his powers come from that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And he's this major Cold War deterrent because essentially he has control over all atomic and subatomic particles. He is, according to Wikipedia, absolutely powerful, invulnerable. He can reconstruct his body in seconds. He can reshape himself. He is inexhaustible. He controls all atomic and subatomic particles. He is omnikinetic. He has no need for sustenance, be it water, food, air, or sleep. He is immortal. He can teleport. He can fly. He can see all of time simultaneously, past, present, and future. He can move through everything wholly or partially. He is able to reduplicate himself. He creates force fields. He can destroy anything. He can disintegrate. He can create and destroy objects. He has telekinesis. He can repair anything, and he can create life, and has claimed to have walked on the sun itself. And by the way, the best bit of all is he is naked.
Because
of his atomic control, he sees no need for clothes. They're completely pointless. So Alan Moore, who drew him, basically created him with classical understated genitalia, like you'd see on the Statue of David or something like that, so they wouldn't be distracting.
Classical understated genitalia. Yeah, that is a lovely phrase.
So I think Dr. Manhattan is pretty... If you were to be a superhero, that's like the genie with infinite wishes sort of thing. You've got pretty much everything in there.
I'm going to argue against that on 2 points. Firstly...
I'm having such a lovely time up to now, Ben.
Yeah. Firstly, I think that Thor can probably stand up to him, because how do we know that the gods who live in
Asgard,
thank you, are made of atomic and subatomic particles?
This is true.
And also, I almost went for Thor over Iron Man as well, because, Chris Hemsworth. But also, whose life would you like? Dr. Manhattan is basically viewed by most people as either a weapon or a terrifying god.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to befriend him. He basically fails to understand human beings, and in the Watchmen comics breaks his only close romantic relationship, because from his point of view, it's pointless, because he sees life as just the sands of time running through his fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you were Iron Man, you could build a replica of every single Formula One circuit in your back garden and then play it out like some sort of real-life dinky Super Mario F1.
And you're saying Dr. Manhattan couldn't do that at zero cost and zero time passing?
Yeah, but he wouldn't enjoy it.
But he wouldn't enjoy it, that's it.
Yeah, you've gone for stats and powers, and that's great. I'm talking about who would you want to be? Would you want to stand up and say, I'm Dr. Manhattan, because I'll level with you, swipe left. Whereas if you just go, I'm Iron Man, A, swipe right. And if they don't swipe right, you're fucking Tony Stark. You can, like, change it so they do swipe right. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. We don't have anyone to decide. Here, you can have this one, Ben. It's fine. I don't mind. I don't really know who Dr. Manhattan is. I just found him in the research.
Have you not read Watchmen?
No, I haven't read any of these.
Oh, mate. Or like, honestly, one of the finest books of the 20th century.
Mm. Cool. Well,
cool. That's the sound of a man who is not going to read a graphic novel.
Yeah, it's the sound of someone who isn't as emotionally invested in his candidate as he likes to make out.
Fair enough. No, it's like, genuinely, Dr. Manhattan is one of the great characters of 20th century fiction and one of the finest stories written in the 20th century.
He sounds really existential. He sounds like he should have been written by Camus.
Yeah, he is.
Or Sartre.
He's a brilliant character, but he's an arsehole.
Yeah.
It makes me worry that God might be an arsehole. So, number three, for episode 3, we went to a topic very close to my heart, and we talked about the world's worst Beatles song.
That's right.
I mean...
Jay Foreman.
Yes.
Our winner was Don't Pass Me By, I think.
Yeah, it was a Ringo one.
Yes, a Ringo one.
It had to be a Ringo one, which is a little unfair, because some of the Ringo ones are lovely, mostly the ones that Ringo had no part in writing, but I think he wrote Don't Pass Me By, and it is... dreadful. The only reason that its dreadfulness doesn't stand out more is because it's hidden in the middle of the White Album, which is an incredible chocolate box of songs where you might get the greatest truffle ever made, or you might get a chocolate covered mousetrap.
I feel like the middle of the White Album is the bit of the podcast that you've kind of half fallen asleep during when you're going to bed at night. So, you know when you wake up and you go, I remember this bit. And then if you re-listen to a podcast, and you go about halfway through, you go, oh, I sort of vaguely remember this and there was that. And then don't they mention marshmallows at some point? That's the middle of the White Album is that, where it's sort of all a bit of a weak haze.
It's an end of side one. Like the first 10 or 11 tracks are pretty magnificent, apart from the continuing story of Bungalow Bill that I grow less tolerant of with each passing year.
Yeah.
And then, but because the starter side two is great.
Yeah.
Starter side two is great. And then it's all just, if you listen to it before, it's like, right, when's Revolution Number 9 coming? When's it coming? When's it coming? And then it comes on, and every time I listen to the White Album in full, I'm like, am I a purist? Or am I someone who likes to have a nice time? And about 3 minutes in, I discover that I'm someone who likes to have a nice time. And then you skip on, you go, oh, it's Ringo singing us a lullaby. Oh, delightful.
No. I read a bit about Don't Pass Me By. You know, it's been covered twice. Really? Even though we picked, there are Beatles songs that have never been covered. Most of the Beatles songs have been covered at one time or another, but Don't Pass Me By has two covers, as does my suggestion in that episode, Maxwell's Silver Hammer.
Yeah.
So I've gone a bit route one with this, Ben. I've gone with Yesterday. I knew you'd react. I always got so mainstream.
Listen, it is a beautiful song with a genuinely astonishing piece of orchestration behind it.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
It's the classic thing. Someone reminded me of the quote the other day about talent hits a target no one else can hit. Genius hits a target no one else can see.
Yeah.
And some of the chord changes in that and some other Beatles songs, like, how would you even conceive of doing that?
Yeah, it's got a really interesting story. It's speaking of covers, there are about 4,000 recordings of Yesterday from the 20th and 21st century. People like Sinatra, Marvin Gaye, Ray Charles, and Daffy Duck have all covered it at one time or another. According to BMI...
Hang on, let's just pause for a moment and enjoy Yesterday.
BMI say that Yesterday was probably performed about 7 million times in the 20th century.
BMI, how does that affect your body mass index if you're singing Yesterday?
Or British Midlands.
Ah, yes.
And it was voted by listeners of BBC Two as the best song of the 20th century, number one pop song by both MTV and Rolling Stone. So, I mean, it's got serious kudos behind it. And, you know, Paul isn't one to not blow his own trumpet when he gets the chance. He says it's the most complete thing I've ever written. It's very catchy without being silly, which I think is pretty fair. A lot of the Beatles songs that we love are kind of catchy because they've got like a sort of a jaunty childishness to it, but it's quite a serious song, but simple as well. It charted for all those 4,000 covers. It has a 1 in 1,000 chance of charting. It has charted 4 times in the UK. The Beatles version, Matt Monro's version, Ray Charles' version, and a version by Marianne Faithfull are the only 4 times it's actually reached the charts. And before he wrote it in 1963 in Jane Asher's attic when he was dating, Paul was dating Jane Asher.
When Jane Asher had grounded him and was like, go upstairs and don't come out until you've written one of the greatest songs of all time. Yeah.
And he said he dreamed it. People probably know that story, but he woke up and he put the word scrambled eggs to it. Scrambled eggs, oh, you've got such lovely legs, until they could come up with some decent words. I would imagine if they'd left it. But he was so convinced that he'd stolen it, he played it to lots of other people to check that he hadn't taken someone else's tune, because he couldn't believe it had come so fully formed to him that he thought, I must have heard this from somewhere else. But that was 1963. They didn't record it properly until 1965. Mm-hmm. And it was turned down by a couple of singers in the interim, by a guy called Billy J. Kramer and Chris Farlow. Both had the chance to have Yesterday. Wow. And they're like, yeah, no, it's fine. You can have it. But the rest of the Beatles didn't really like it. They said they don't want it as a single. I think George Martin had suggested it was a Paul song, and Brian Epstein was very much of the opinion that, no, these are the Beatles and we're not having sort of solo songs.
Yeah, of course.
So they all sort of vetoed it. But that, yeah, I just think I really like it as a song. It's really, I think, simple. Where there's a lot to be said for a simple but interesting sort of musical chorus or a melody, and then simple words with a bit of pathos to it.
Lovely. Well, here's 5 minutes on why you're wrong.
No, why don't you go 5 minutes on what your choice is instead?
No, we all know how fandom works. It's not anything to do about what I like. It's what to do with other people and why they're wrong.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful song. It's all those sort of songs Lennon used to get really narky at. And he'd call them stuff like something like sad songs for sad people and their sad little lives.
Yeah.
Particularly talking about Eleanor Rigby with that one.
Yes. Just because Paul wrote it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, sometimes Lennon can be really funny. Like, I love on Let It Be before They play Let It Be. You can hear Lennon go, and now we're going to play Ark the Angels Come. Like, you snide wanker, John. I think Paul wrote better solo songs.
Mm-hmm.
Blackbird.
Blackbird is great.
And it's not a solo song, but For No One on Revolver. As a sort of a bittersweet ballad of nostalgia and regret, it's gorgeous, and it's got a French horn that is playing outside of its natural range, and it gives that sort of voice-breaking feel to it as well. Mm. But I think the best song of that type, of the Yesterday type, of a song sort of trying to encapsulate the whole human experience and regretting one thing, is In My Life.
Yeah.
Like Lennon clearly took one look at Yesterday and saw that and went, I'll see you and raise you, mate. It's a wonderful, wonderful song. And I think the lyrics to In My Life are better than Yesterday. I think the melody's better. The hook is definitely better.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got George Martin playing a speeded up Mellotron in the middle, which when I played In My Life at my house a couple of months ago and it went on, and my wife, when that bit went on, went, what the hell's that? And in her language, it meant, what the hell's that? I don't like it.
Yeah.
And my response was, correct, it is sonically inventive, my darling.
God, but you're a nightmare to live with.
Yeah. I am an absolute delight. But my suggestion, you might be able to hear in the background, listeners, small crinkling sounds, and that is the sound of Barry's husband doing his taxes in the background.
You're not going to suggest Taxman.
No! No, although Taxman is a great song. Taxman basically gave Paul Weller his entire career.
Yes.
Okay, it's got an absolute...
Oh, God. I need to stop mentioning Beatles songs.
You do, because it's got one hell of a thunderous riff, which is really good fun to play. I don't know if it has backwards guitar solos in, but the guitar solo in it is, again, an absolute rocker. And it mentions two British Prime Ministers, Edward Heath and... Is it Callaghan? No, Macmillan.
Don't worry, listeners. We'll put a time break for when you just skip forward to the next subject.
Yes,
that's what the rustling is in the background.
No, the reason I'm saying that is because Mikey popped up a piece of paper with the word because on, which is one track away from my favourite. Because is incredible. Track A on Abbey Road. And it sort of sounds like the Beatles trying to do choral music written by Beethoven, but they've turned the music upside down by mistake.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. And reminds me of one other little nerdy Beatles fact before we get to my suggestion. Do you know what the only Beatles track that the Beatles didn't play a single instrument on is?
Is it Wonderwall?
This podcast is over. No, it was Eleanor Rigby.
Did they not?
No, it's just a string quartet.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah.
And it's weird, because the Beatles were getting away from all that sort of stodgy, clumpy 40s and 50s music.
Yeah, string quartet and Yesterday.
There is, but Paul's also playing the guitar.
I know. I just like it.
Yeah, no, and it's lovely, but also not as good as the Eleanor Rigby string quartet. My suggestion is track 9 on Abbey Road called You Never Give Me Your Money.
Okay.
And it is...
It must be really good. I've never heard of it, Ben. I really want us to do a series of podcasts about Beatles songs just to wind you up.
Have you genuinely never heard it before?
No!
Right, well, we know what we're doing as soon as this podcast is over. So it's the first song...
Why is it the best song I've ever heard of?
I am trying to keep my temper for some lovely podcast listening.
Coaching you before for when your child arrives.
Oh, mate.
It'll have arrived by the time this goes out.
It will have done. If my child doesn't like You Never Give Me Your Money, then two bricks in a sack, wanging it in the Thames.
That's what your child's going to be saying to you.
Yeah. It's going to be saying it to
your
mum.
Yeah.
Not to my mum, to its mum. Jesus. Yeah. So it's the start of the medley on the second side of Abbey Road.
Mm-hmm.
You know about the medley?
Sure.
Oh, how can you be a grown-up, sensitive, creative, artistic human being and not have an appreciation of Abbey Road?
I've listened to it. I haven't listened to it 1,000 times.
You're fucking bereft.
Right.
Basically, Abbey Road was when the Beatles were like at each other's throats, and they still managed to create some of the most beautiful music of all time.
Yeah.
And they had loads of different scraps of songs that they couldn't really form into one song, into sort of fully fleshed out three verse and chorus songs. So they decided to do 8-song medley sort of had themes that would come back and forth in it. And the start of it is You Never Give Me Your Money. It is a song sort of about how Paul felt about all of the financial wranglings that the Beatles were having with each other.
Sounds like more like a George thing, to be honest.
It really does. And they brought in a guy called Alan Klein to basically sort out the finances, because Brian Epstein was dead,
yeah.
So they sort of felt like their father figure had gone. Alan Klein came along and basically sort of ripped them off a bit. And Paul was furious about that. For Paul, they are very, very bitter lyrics. So, like, I never give you my number. I only give you my situation. And in the middle of investigation, I break down. And talking about getting away from the Beatles. One street dream, pick up the bags, get in the limousine. Soon we'll be away from here. Step on the gas, wipe that tear away. So lyrically, it's uncharacteristically bitter from him, but the music is everything. It starts with sort of Paul doing delightful Sunday school hymnal piano playing. Mm-hmm. And then they sort of rock out. They do boogie woogie. There's nursery rhymes and harmonies in it and arpeggios, and it segues into this really gorgeous chilled out Latin song called Sun King, and it's
sinking, honey. Sorry, go on.
As you were. It's, I love songs that transmogrify into different parts. I love Bohemian Rhapsody.
It sounds like Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, that and Paranoid Android. There's a Frank Zappa song called Peaches Own Regalia that is about 15 different songs in one song.
Mr. Blue Sky.
Yes, of course. That as well. And this is like that. It's got everything you could want from the Beatles. It's got some rocking out. It's got optimism. It's got heartbreak. It's got a little bit of bitterness. It's got wicked guitar solos.
Cool.
And it's better than Yesterday.
Cool. Well, I think we're agreed that Yesterday is the best
Beatles
song.
Yep, absolutely. Well done, everyone.
Hi there. Did you know that nice used to mean stupid? Or that heckling used to be an important trade in Scottish port cities? Or that the connection between a fallen tree and important pieces of narrative exposition in Star Trek can be found on the open ocean way back in the Age of Sail? If you like language and learning nerdy bits of trivia behind everyday words, come along and join us at Lexitecture, a brand new podcast all about word origins and histories. Find us on Facebook and Twitter by searching Lexitecture, LexitecTure, on our website at lexitecture.com, and anywhere you get your podcasts.
Next episode, we had Ellie Gibson as our guest. Ellie, of course, from Darrow Breen's Go 8-Bit. And we talked about the world's worst console game. I think we picked Takeshi no Chusenju, the impossible game created by Takeshi, the host of Takeshi's Castle.
Mm-hmm.
What suggestions have you got for the best console game?
I went back to my childhood for this. So when I was a little boy in Newcastle, once a year there used to be a travelling fair that would come to the town we were called the Hoppings. And I'd go along with my brother and we'd go to the arcade games that were popped up there. Mm-hmm. And they had a game that in Japan was known as Orinpiku or Hyper Olympic, but over here was known as Track and Field.
Oh, yeah.
Track and Field.
That's the dude doing the hurdling. And is that one of the ones in it? There's a guy doing hurdling
in
it?
Yeah, yeah. It is literally all of the main events that you would see at the Olympic track and field.
But in like 8-bit.
But in 8-bit... But an 8-bit.
Amazing.
And the only way that you can operate him is you build up speed by getting a lighter or a pen and flicking it furiously over the B button. And then you press the A button down to get the angle, press it again to decide when he should jump. And then he jumped. That's how you do all the field events, and then the track events is just flicking it over and over and over and over and over again until the lactic acid builds up in your shoulder and you collapse in front of the arcade. But it's so addictive. And it's also... The fact that it takes an activity that is social, mm-hmm, and healthy,
yep,
and good for you, yep, and turns it 8-bit.
Was it available on consoles?
Yes, it was. Oh, it was cool. Available on the NES and the SNES.
Cool.
It's
like computer console designers basically went, what's the game that we can most make children look like they're wanking when their parents walk into the room behind them? With the console in front of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but wanking with a weird little clicking noise. So they're just going, do you have a button in your penis? Oh my God, imagine if we had a turbo button in our penis. Never
mind. Chris Pratt uses to calm his velociraptor in the Jurassic World films.
Oh my God. I mean, Chris Pratt calming his velociraptor is a unique search on Pornhub.
I've gone really classic. I have such happy memories of playing GoldenEye 007 on the N64. Ben is already making stupid face at me. I don't care what you say. The hours spent on a sofa playing multiplayer versions of that with my brother and friends. Just some of the happiest hours of my life.
I'll tell you my problem with GoldenEye is that I can't play first-person shooters because I get motion sickness. I was the coolest kid in sixth form.
Oh, dear God. It's great. I loved it. Particularly, like, the arguments you would have over, don't be the wanker who gets the golden gun and just stands beside where the golden gun reappears all the time. Or don't be odd job. That's a dick move. You're too short. No one can shoot you. Or the best thing would be playing a game and seeing on that four screen split that you'd have, seeing that someone else was sneaking up behind a third person and going like, this is going to be brilliant.
I just found it so stressful.
Oh, so stressful. Come on. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, the best thing ever. I read a bit about it. It sold 8 million units
wow.
at the time. Yeah, it was amazing. It wasn't a film tie-in as well. It came out a couple of years after the movie, which is probably just as well that, you know, they took the time to design it properly. Because of the 10, only 10 people really worked on it, 10 creators, and only 2 of them had ever made a video game before. Isn't that amazing?
That's astonishing.
It's, yeah, ridiculous.
With bands, when they just sort of like, you know, when the Stone Roses just thunk out a debut album and it's yeah. brilliant, you're just yeah. like, okay, well done. But to deal with a computer game is out of this world.
Yeah, a lot of their faces are in the game as well. A lot of the sort of yeah. the office workers or the like the labs, the people in lab coats and so on are faces of the guys who designed the game. It's illegal to sell it to minors in Germany because of the representations of death in it. Fun German laws that are hangovers from the Cold War.
Wasn't it? But I thought it was a 18 anyway, wasn't it?
I don't think it is here. No, I think it was maybe 50. It's whatever the rating the Bond films probably are, I think. Certainly in Germany, you weren't allowed to sell it to underage people. The multiplayer thing, which was the big, like, mm-hmm. the big selling point for a lot of people, was added a month before the game was released. It was an afterthought. Hmm. Like, they were designing the game for about 2 years, and they whacked it together in a few weeks. And initially people were like, oh, we're not really bothered by it. Even the executives in Nintendo, all the way throughout the development process, really weren't that keen on the game. It's like they had no idea of the hit they were about to have on their hand, like the third highest selling game for the N64.
It's not a very Nintendo game. That's what I'm delighted by with Nintendo. Mm. It is like, Nintendo is like playing a cartoon, like playing a yeah. happy comic book in fact.
And it was nearly a 2D, like it was nearly going to be a scroller, a platformer, mm-hmm. because I think they'd had a Donkey Kong game that was sort of a platform game come out shortly before. It was very successful, so we'll just replicate that and it'll be sort of one of those railroaded shooter games. But no, then the slightly open world feel of it was part of the success for it. 12s. I think it was rated 12, yeah. actually, yeah. Oh. Says our researcher in the corner. You can find a CCTV copy. In one of the missions in the bunker, you have to find a CCTV video. And if you look at that video in your inventory, it shows the cover of the copy of the film GoldenEye. A little Easter egg for you. They originally wanted you to reload your weapon by unplugging and plugging back in the rumble pack on your controller.
That's great.
Yeah, it was just it was just not feasible. It was like the controller would have freaked out.
There was the thing with GoldenEye, like the games that it developed into. I met someone whose 15-year-old son was explaining to me, he was playing, you know, Call of Duty yeah. or whatever.
Version. It's influenced all of those.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
of course.
It's genuinely one of the most influential games of all time.
And this kid was a very smart young man who was in the top 1% of players of this online, which meant that he was able to win weapons and then sell them to other game players for actual money.
Wow.
And we're talking several hundred pounds. Yeah.
It's so weird.
Yeah, that's
esports freaks me out.
Yeah, esports is the first thing to make me feel old and like yeah. I no longer understand the young people.
Yeah. Couple more things about this. In 2014, Pierce Brosnan played Jimmy Fallon on Jimmy's chat show in a game of GoldenEye and was so bad that he wasn't even able to pick up any guns. And finally, fun facts about the GoldenEye. It's a type of duck. It was a contingency plan for if the Nazis invaded Spain, developed by the British Naval Intelligence. of which Ian Fleming was a member. And it was also the name of his estate in Jamaica, the GoldenEye Estate.
Was it?
Yeah. So, I think GoldenEye is phenomenal. And because of its influence on other games, I think it's probably got to be up ahead of Track and Field. Surely.
Surely. All I'm saying is...
This is more tense than our usual podcast.
It really is, isn't it? We really do need a third person here to sort of break the tension. The unspoken partner here, the third person saying GoldenEye. My only thing is, if you're going to gather the family around a console of an evening, do you want your nana to be furiously masturbating with
lighter? You want her trapped in the facility with slappers only. Our final topic was the world's worst political protest.
Yeah.
We had Tiernan Dieb as our guest. My story of the Animal Liberation Front's release of 5,000 mink into the south of England slayed all before it in that episode.
Glorious. Still one of my favourite things we've ever found out.
Will I go first?
Yeah.
I read about the Women of Liberia Mass Action for Peace. Ben has given me the thumbs up. Is that your choice as well?
No, not at all. It's just a lovely, lovely story.
It's so good. I think we've talked about Lysistrata on their episode with Dan Bai about political theatre. Lysistrata, for listeners, is a Greek play about the women of Athens going on sex strike to try and force the men to end the Peloponnesian War. And it's kind of a comedy and a satire, but, you know, sex strikes proved to be quite effective during the Liberian Civil War. So there was a civil war in Liberia for about 14 years, 1989-2003. President Samuel Doe was overthrown in a coup. Charles Taylor succeeded him as president. Doe was tortured to death on camera. Over the 14 years, about 250,000 lives were lost, thousands and thousands of people displaced by the war, and horrible, horrible conflict. And in 2003, this group, the Women of Liberia Mass Action for Peace, came to prominence. They were led by a woman called Lema Gbowe, along with people like Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who became the president of Liberia in 2006, Africa's first female president. And the women basically were... sick and tired of the men and their war, and particularly, of course, like things like rape and sex crimes against them and their children, and or having their sons taken away to war and drugged up and returning home shells of human beings years later and all this sort of stuff. So they decided that a sex strike was the most effective way of getting attention. They got their, because you get your men talking by explaining, well, I'm not having sex with you because this civil war is still going on. So it's a reward for good men that they get to have sex if they're then talking to their friends saying, you know, this civil war thing, I'm not so keen on it now, I'm not getting laid anymore. Genuinely, I read an interview with Lema Gbowe where she's like, well, you know, men are all interested in the act of sex and it got them talking. So, I mean, from that sense, it was effective. And they were able to force President Taylor to the negotiation table, and that's when it really kicked off, because they held these peace talks in Ghana. And a delegation from the Women of Liberia arrived in Ghana, 200 of them, surrounding the room where the peace talks took place, dressed in white. And if any of the men tried to leave the negotiations, the women would threaten to strip. And they had men trying to climb out the windows to get out, like leave the go. And they were just like, no, you guys are staying in here until you sort this shit out.
That's astonishing.
It's amazing.
It's what's most astonishing is that it hasn't sort of caught on around the world.
I know, right? They staged this sit-in and would not leave until a peace was hammered out. And eventually it led to sort of the warring factions coming to terms with each other. In 2006, as I said, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf succeeded Taylor as president. It brought loads more women into politics in Liberia. She dealt with inheritance rights. She made rape punishable by death. Much more equitable society. And the happiest of happy endings, Charles Taylor was later done for war crimes.
Hooray!
Hooray! So I think, you know, as political protests go, A, it was effective, which is a good starting point, but B, it's also very striking as tactics go. And it draws from classical mythology, which and theatre, which you and I can appreciate.
Yes, we can.
I'm sure they were all thumbing through their copies of Lysistrata while holding the French windows shut with their breasts up against the glass of that negotiating chamber in Ghana.
What a... Yeah. I mean, I'd be fascinated to read the GCSE history syllabus of Liberia in 20 years' time. Like, our mums did what? Well, I've got a lot more frivolous things that probably aren't going to stand up against that. I found a lovely picture of pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong who created a roadblock, and they had really long rods, and on the end of it, each one, there was a glove that was flicking the bird at the police.
Amazing. Was this at the same time as they had the umbrella protests?
Yes.
Yeah, oh, they were... They were inventive protesters.
Remind me of the umbrella protests again.
I think the umbrella became their sort of their symbol. They were all carrying umbrellas at these protests.
Yeah, so I saw that. Another one, great one for men in India protesting for women's rights, particularly protesting against sexual assault. And there was the normal tedious justification that women in skimpy outfits provoked sexual assault. So the men went, so you're saying that wearing skimpy outfits provoke sexual assault, do you? Yes. Bear with me while I pop to the wardrobe. Just a lovely picture of these slightly embarrassed, but nevertheless wonderfully honest and just Indian men all wearing skimpy Indian miniskirts.
Amazing.
And singlets. So they're just like, I feel terrible, but this is the right thing to do.
Yeah, oh, that's great.
My favourite nickname for a protester is, I mean, this has been going on for about 10, 15 years, but breastfeeding women who did various protests, like basically breastfeeding sit-ins to protest against people being told to hide away in the bathroom.
Yeah.
They were nicknamed the Lactivists. Just wonderful, isn't
awesome.
It?
Awesome. Well done.
But my my favourite protest of all time also involves milk, but not breast milk. It involves cow milk. So there were dairy farmers, and they've done this on more than one occasion, who were protesting against plunging milk prices.
Where was this?
This is in Brussels. So okay. But these are farmers from all EU-wide. Around the EU,
okay.
EU-wide, and they went to Brussels. They did the 1,000 tractors to Brussels protest, which is clearly the slowest protest in history. And when they got there, they sprayed the parliament in milk.
Oh...
But my favourite bit of it is after they'd like sprayed the parliament with milk and there was fresh milk running down the street,
yeah.
When the riot police turned up, they turned the milk cannons on the riot police.
Oh, no.
And they gushed milk at the riot police.
I'm imagining the movie version side on shot of the milk meeting the stream of water from the water cannons. like wizards firing their energy at each other.
Yeah, well that's basically it was a farmer's Patronus. Yeah. Just milk being fired out like an angry milk.
But they massive tankers then and hoses and all of that. Or just one really, really powerful cow.
Come on, Bessie, come on.
On a crane dangling above the European Parliament. Jean-Claude Juncker down below.
She needs a little bit more juice. Feed her some chilies. Feed her some chilies.
That's excellent. I like that a lot. I mean, we have to go with the women of Liberia.
We do have to go with the women of Liberia.
Because, you know, it's quite a serious subject, but... In terms of hilarious protests, I'm a big fan of the Lactivists,
yeah.
Both Brest and Brussels.
I mean, what would have been great is if the women of Liberia had used these tactics as well. If the men tried to leave the negotiating table, women of Liberia, engage your breasts.
It's Iron Man.
It's Iron Woman.
Bionic boob.
Bionic boob.
Lovely.
So yeah, that's that. Well, what a cracking collection. We've decided that chess therapy,
Iron Man.
You never give me your money. I refuse to let you have yesterday.
Golden Eye,
and the Liberian women are our first five best of the bests.
Well done, all of them.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Well, listen, thanks for listening to this episode. Hopefully we'll be back next week with one of our usual ones, but very much depends on when my son or daughter shows up, and how
we're recording this what 4 days before the due date.
Yeah, we absolutely are.
Do let us know on Twitter or by a message on email. You can send us messages via our website as well, or email us worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. If you liked this episode, if you'd like to hear more of them, it's the first time trying out something like this for the two of us. Or if you're like, no, there was too much Barry and Ben and not enough of someone else chipping in.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, if you do like this, we'll carry on doing the odd best of the best from time to time. We'll do some other special episodes. Anyway, we're all off to the farm to lock and load with an AK Mooty 7. Until next time, bye.
Bye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.